watching the detectives. He gets so angry when the teardrops start, but you can't fool it cause you got no heart. Watching the detectives. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you love antiques, you love PBS television, and if you follow antique-related PBS shows, you're a fan of The History Detectives, a series now in its eighth season. The detectives research the history behind mystery objects, and those objects can be just about anything. Joining us today are two history detectives, Elise Lorraine. Before joining the detectives, she was a top appraiser for Christie Auction House, where she was allowed to research the authenticity of some amazing objects, including Julie Garland's ruby slippers. Welcome to the show, Elise.
Thank you.
And welcome back to History Detective Wes Cohen, who also is a featured PBS antiques appraiser and who owns and operates a busy business in antique auctions. Welcome back, Wes.
Thanks very much. Great to be back.
You know, the song at the outset, of course, is the theme song. It's the History Detective's theme song, which is the Elvis Costello song called Watching the Detectives. And it's kind of a strange song, and I wondered about it, the application to it. But one thing that struck me was the "when the tears fall" phrase, and something I noticed in a couple of the shows I was watching over the three segments that have aired so far in the season is people get very emotional about these objects.
Well, there's no question about that. I know I'm speaking. Elise can have her own stories about this, but this has happened with me several times where not only the person who owns the object will start crying, the person who we're interviewing has not really any relationship to the object will start crying, and they'll get very emotional about being caught up in the story.
I think the
key also is that the reason why the show is so successful is that everybody has history, and what we try to show is that we all connect to history. And that's the emotional tie into it, is that each piece that we have, we tie it into something that's personal for everybody.
And there's always a real person behind it. It's not just a series of events. There's usually at the core a human being, and it very much comes to life.
Well, that's what history basically is, if you think about it.
Exactly. And yet they're objects. They're inanimate objects. I was kind of wondering, on the website, there's a list of some of the tools that your team uses to solve historical mysteries, and I was wondering what of those proves, I don't know if you'd say proves the most effective, but what among those, what do you use the most often? I noticed the library is very popular.
Well, I think that first that people who are listening to the show should know that both Elise and I, as well as the other detectives, also have lives beyond PBS, and we simply don't have the time to do the research that's necessary for every show. Every show takes about six weeks worth of work to put together before filming really starts, and there's a team of researchers in New York at the production company Lion Television or at Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland, Oregon, that are working on these stories, doing the basic research, so that when Elise and I show up on the show, the research is basically already done. And I would say that of the tools that the research team are using, libraries are exceptionally important. But you know, the internet is the place where everything starts, because the internet provides the threads that you can pull to find where you need to go and who to talk to.
But I always say that Google is not research, but Google is the perfect place for us to start.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Wes is totally right, but we do also have to say that if it wasn't for the historians, the libraries, and the experts that actually start, that do it for us, then we wouldn't be able to have the show.
And there's usually somebody out there who's an expert, a specialist, or a buff.
Yes, and if it wasn't for those experts, those specialists, those buffs, we wouldn't be able to do the show. As Wes said, when we start production for the show, a lot of times we have to do research beforehand, and those people are doing the research for us. So they're really the people that help us. And remember, everybody is an expert in a little something of their own hometown that relates to helping us do the research for the television show. So those people, their expertise are extremely important to us when we're doing research.
And I think that, if I can just chip in here, I think that that's one thing that makes the show so appealing. We get to talk to people who are a whole lot smarter than we are and who are really experts in these little minute slices of American history. And these are the people that really make the story come to life and flesh it out and give it depth and character.
Absolutely.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820, and you're listening to Wes Cohen and Elise Luray. They're both PBS history detectives. The show is in its eighth season, and I'm not going to give away anything. I don't want to be a spoiler. If you want to go online, you can see the episodes that have aired already online at the History Detectives website. We'll post that on WOSU.org/allsides if you want to give that a look. But there are a few of the shows, there are a few moments in the shows that I would like to look at, beginning with season 8, episode 1, The Space Boot. It's one story that Elise investigated, and it involved the great race to the moon between the United States and the Soviet Union, and Elise traced the history of an odd-looking boot.
Chris Raddus of Lucas, Kentucky, thinks he owns a prototype of one of the space age inventions that helped man travel to the moon.
My dad brought this boot home from work, and I asked him what it was. He told me he couldn't tell me, but we'd find out later.
So what's in the box?
This is the boot my father, Raymond Raddus, brought home from Westinghouse Electric, where he worked as an engineer.
And what year did he bring this home?
It was probably 1963, I think.
Well, it's kind of a strange-looking boot. Wow, and it's heavy. What are these things?
These are magnets. From what I understand, it was invented for astronauts to use outside the spaceship during the Gemini missions.
So these magnets would stick the astronauts to the spacecraft in zero-G?
That's what I understand, yeah. That was what the family, you know, our family lore is.
So, Elise, the boot never made it into space, but it represents part of America history nonetheless.
Well, sure it does, because, you know, if you think about this time period, the race to the moon was really top secret. So we really didn't know as citizens what we needed to get to the moon. Only the people that worked for NASA did. But it was an excellent time for people to be entrepreneurs or to try to make things, be developers, inventors, and try to think of things that would get us to the moon. And it was a great opportunity that if you could find something, you know, you could really become very successful and very rich. But at the same time, you didn't have the resources to find out exactly what you needed.
I thought it was interesting that Westinghouse sort of set him loose, and other engineers like him, inventors, they were permitted to devote a certain percentage of their workday to anything they wanted.
They did, but remember, most of it was done on their free time. They were given a small amount of time to try to figure something out and do whatever they wanted, because it would be in Westinghouse's best interest had something turned out to be able to be used for the moon and to be patented. But a lot of this was done on their own time, you know, people hoping to have the next big invention.
How do you decide that something like the boot is worth looking into?
It's the story that it tells. If we can connect it to a bigger piece of American history and it has a compelling story, that's the ones we usually pick. Wes probably gets the most inquiries because he has his auction house in Ohio. But we submit them to PBS, and then if we can connect them to a bigger picture, then that's usually what they pick.
Yeah, and I would I'd also be quick to point out that the History Detectives website asks for pitches all the time from, and we as detectives do ask for people to submit their story ideas to the PBS website. History Detectives PBS website, and they get about, I think at last count, about 8,000 story suggestions from viewers on an annual basis. So there are actually people in New York and in Portland, Oregon, that are sifting through these story ideas, and a lot of them, frankly, are just, you know, they're non-starters. And they don't even look at them. The team doesn't really look at them. But then there are a number that people start working on, and then they find out that they don't have any, that there's no legs there, and there's a dead end, and they get dropped. Dropped. And then there's a certain number of stories that will make compelling television that do get picked and actually get filmed.
How do you decide which one you're going to do?
It's based upon who's available when.
Okay. My world and welcome to it, right?
Exactly. I don't think that there's no rhyme or reason how we get chosen. I'm still mad at Elise from the first season. She got to go to Alaska, and I didn't get to go. Dadgone it.
I don't know. It looks like you're sometimes running around quite a bit, moving.
We are running. We are definitely running. One of my last shows, I was in five states in 4 days.
Lots of wardrobe changes.
Yes. Lots of miles.
Have there been shows that have gotten to a certain point or investigations that have gotten to a certain point that have just ended in utter disappointment that just wasn't going to work? It got very far along and turned out to be nothing? Or you don't even really get involved until it's something?
Well, we don't get involved until that point. But I can tell you on the space story, Gwen's story, we've been working on that for, I don't know, Wes, how many years they've been working on that story. And finally, because we couldn't figure out who John was, we said, okay, let's just throw it out to the public and let's end it that way.
This is the story of the microchip that was carried to the moon that had Andy Warhol drawing and Jasper Johns. I can't remember.
Right.
I think you just watched it. But that specific story, if you watch it at the ending, we cannot figure out the ending, so we throw it to the public and say, if you can figure this out. I also did a story, a Grace Kelly car many, many years ago, and it turned out not to be the car. We weren't going to do the story, and we said, you know what, let's do the story and throw it to the public and say, if you think you have Grace Kelly's car, send us the VIN number. And we've been getting emails each year from there, people thinking they finally found the car. We haven't found it yet, but, those are exceptions that we have done, but there are things that we've worked on for many years.
And I was involved in a story that I actually brought to the producers of History Detectives that involved a really rare document. I won't say what it was, but it was an incredibly rare document. And the question was, who penned this document?
Uh-huh.
And it was related to George Washington. So the question was, who penned this document? The producers of History Detectives and researchers for this particular segment spent almost a year trying to figure out who penned this document, never could, and finally decided they wouldn't air the show. I mean, it never was filmed, but it would have been an incredible story. But they could not figure out who penned the document, and everything hinged on that identity.
You know, it's such an amazing moment, just as an observer, just as a part of the audience, to be it where it shows incontrovertibly there is a connection to the famous person that you thought it might be connected to, and that's such a cool feeling. And all I'm doing is watching it.
yeah, we like that.
It really is, and the reason the show, and I say this in every public presentation that I give about the show, the reason the show is so popular is that it touches on, and Elise alluded to this earlier, it touches on Americans' deep interest in American history. And I make the distinction between history with a capital H, the kind of history that we learn in our survey courses in high school and college, where we have this sort of broad sweep of history, pilgrims landed Plymouth Rock, French and Indian Wars, American Revolution, War of 1812, so on, versus that's history with the big H, versus what I think is more compelling to most Americans, and that's what I call history with a little H, and that's the history that ties an individual's family to some larger topic of American history. For example, most people have something in their house that has been handed down to them from an ancestor that has some story attached to it, and it might be nothing more than, oh, this is a table that moved to Ohio when my family came from Philadelphia in 1810. But that's the thing that gets people's blood running and their pulse rushing. It's the individual stories that relate their family to some larger topic in American history. It's history with a little age. That's what people like about History Detectives.
I got to take a break right now. We'll return, though, with Wes Cohen and Elise Luray of the PBS History Detectives. If you have a question or comment, you know, you can call 614-292-8513. Or you can always email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. We take questions and comments there as well. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Great Plains cities are booming while the rest of the country's economy is in trouble. We'll look at what's going on in a part of the country some were willing to write off for dead. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins later this afternoon at 1 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Currently 83 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1021. Sunny skies today and another warm day with a high right around 95. A slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 71. And then cooler temperatures for tomorrow. Cloudy skies with a chance of rain, maybe a thunderstorm, and a high of 82. And then sunny for Saturday and a high of 85. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are Elise Luray and Wes Cohen, PBS's History Detectives, or two of the group that represent the History Detectives. They're in the eighth season of the series, and the fourth segment is coming up, I think, next week or the week after, so you want to check your PBS station for that. This is next cut is about a viewer from Lancaster, Missouri, who had inherited a wooden cane topped with a coiled snake made of bronze or copper. And in this episode of History Detectives, Wes tries to answer a few of Cynthia Wilcox's questions about her family heirloom.
This is the cane that was handed down. Some families have Bibles they pass down over the years, but ours has a cane.
What do you know about it?
Cindy says that family legend holds that the cane once belonged to her great-great-grandfather, Henry Clay Dean.
What do you know about Henry Clay Dean?
He was a lawyer, a Methodist preacher, and a copperhead back at the time of the Civil War.
Cindy believes her relative may have been a leading member of the Copperheads and opposed Lincoln during the war.
So what is it that you want to know about this cane?
We want to know, how did he get it, where it came from? Is it real?
Wes, that was an interesting episode because at first you doubted the significance they attached to it because there was the copperhead handle, but the rest of the cane was kind of ordinary.
Well, that's right. It was an unbelievable unbelievable bronze casting of a coiled snake that, frankly, I had never seen one like this that was produced during the Civil War. You know, canes are, as an accessory to gentlemen, are a late 19th century phenomenon. So to see this on a cane from the 1860s was pretty remarkable.
And did you ever solve the connection between the fact that it was such an elaborate handle and such an ordinary wood stick?
No, I don't think that there was anything really he was a pretty rough and tumble guy, and as the more I found out about him, the more it made perfect sense that the handle would have matched the head.
This is a really good example of a family being very directly related to the item, such a rare and amazing item. And I notice when I watch Antiques Roadshow and that sort of thing that it makes it more valuable.
That's right. It was a great piece, and we were able to really sort of verify the family history or the family hearsay about it that. You know, this really was the guy's cane. I mean, finding the I'm not going to tell people who haven't watched it.
Right.
But, we found the sort of the nail in the nail in the coffin that really proved this.
Say, Elise, I saw on the website that it says that you never leave home without your appraiser's kit.
Well, Wes probably doesn't either.
Okay, what is that?
Well, at this point it's changed dramatically because we have the computer. When Wes and I first started this whole thing, there wasn't really a computer. But, you know, you need a loupe because you need to look at maker's marks or some type of magnifying glass to look at marks. If I'm going on appraisal, a lot of times I bring something to measure the piece. Measurement is very important. Now, this is very different than if we're doing an investigation. You know, there is a little scene in our investigations where we do a little bit of an appraisal. But going to look at an object to find out its worth, you know, you're looking at it a little bit differently. But there's certain things that you bring to, you know, to look at to make sure you think it's right.
Well, and I say as a as an auctioneer who specializes in all sorts of antiques, you know, it's very important when you make a house call, as we call it in the business, when you go to somebody's place to look at their property, you know, you have a flashlight. If you have to look under a piece of furniture, you got a measuring tape, as Elise said, cameras, loops, all of those things become pretty important.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, remember, the landscape has changed dramatically mm-hmm. since computers have come into play. I mean, it used to be that your library, which still is one of the most important things as an appraiser you need, but years ago, your library was unbelievably important because you constantly had to go looking for comparables and references, and it's a lot easier now that we have the Internet.
Well, yeah, and frankly, I use my, I won't say what brand I use, but my portable PDA, telephone, whatever it is, has a great camera. In fact, it has the capability of taking HD video now. So,
fancy, you
know,
you got the new one.
And you can look up so much stuff instantly. It's just at your fingertips.
Yeah. It's a lot easier now.
Let's listen to another cut from another segment. This is from episode 2. It's about the theremin. A theremin was one of the first electronic instruments. And in this episode of History to Texas, Elise investigates the history of one specific theremin and a document tacked to the inside of its cabinet. In this scene, Elise talked to Rob Schwimmer. He's an original member of the New York Theremin Society. Who knew, right, Elise? And we will hear what a theremin sounds like.
He explains how theremins enjoyed a renaissance in the 1950s.
They had all the sci-fi movies where all of a sudden this sound became synonymous with flying saucers and aliens and stuff like that. This one's from like maybe 1959, or it was made by a guy named Robert Moog.
Moog, Rob tells me, invented the first commercial synthesizer, the instrument that hugely influenced music in the 1960s and 70s.
You know, I remember when I was in a little rock band in the 70s when I was in junior high, and it was such a big deal when one of the guys got a Moog synthesizer. And it was to draw that connection between those two things. But that theremin, I can handle it for a little flying saucer action, but the whole song was kind of creepy.
Yeah, but you know, the interesting thing about it is if you listen to Led Zeppelin or the Beach Boys, mm-hmm. he was actually playing at Madison Square Garden when I was interviewing him that day. So if you listen to it, you'll see that a lot of his music is in music. You don't realize it when you're listening to it as an ensemble.
You had never heard of a theremin, though, when you started this, right?
Never. I'd never even seen it before. Totally brand new.
This was one of those stories that took you from what looked like a desert scenario to the big city.
Yes, it did. I started in Santa Fe, and we ended up in New York.
Do you ever wonder about the folks that are this particular guy in Santa Fe? This was not a family heirloom or anything. I don't think, was it, Elise?
No, he's a collector actually, and he's an inventor as well. He works on automatons, so he's very into mechanics. But there's this whole society of people with theremins that collect them and play them and fix them and try to find them. And that was actually the most fascinating thing to me, because not only did I know that the instrument existed, I didn't know that there was this whole society of people out there, you know, that actually play it. And when we brought the theremin to the Carrymore in New York, people had driven and flown in from all over the country to see this instrument and to also play the other one that we compared it to. And they filmed it, and it was a very big deal to people in the music industry.
The inventor of the theremin, he was from the Soviet Union, and was involved in another invention of his was involved in an international incident between the Soviets and the U.S.
Which is kind of apropos of the present moment, I would say.
Yeah. Can you tell us about that a little bit? It's interesting.
The interesting thing is that really what he's most well known for is the bug. I mean, you know, if you watch any type of spy movies, you're always, you know, we're bugging people. And the Soviet Union at the time had placed a bug in a Boy Scouts, pretty much a paperweight that they had given at the American Embassy. And it had been sitting in the American Embassy for 7 years until it was discovered, and he was the inventor of the bug.
Yeah, it's you never know where you're going to learn something new. I just want to say that the next new episode of History Detectives airs on WOS-TV on Monday night at 9 p.m. And joining me today, Wes Cowan and Elise Luray of the PBS History Detectives on the air now. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sorry about mispronouncing your name, Wes.
Not a problem. Very common.
Who actually pulls together the episodes, and do you have any input on how they're put together?
Well, again, I'm sure Elise will have some great comments about this. But you know, when we start filming, we have a sort of a production log of what scenes we're going to be shooting, with a general outline of what we're supposed to shoot. But everything is very fluid. We're not memorizing any lines. There's no formal script. We might go in. This has happened to me on so many occasions. I can't even describe how often it's happened. When you go in to do a research scene, you're looking at the research materials that the production team has pulled together that you're supposed to be finding something in. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden you see something else, and you say, "Well, wait a minute. We need to include this." I mean, it just, the show is very fluid. It changes from scene to scene while we're shooting.
Don't you just love your jobs?
I do.
Well, you know, I think it's fabulous. What I really like about the job, first, I consider it a great privilege to be able to be invited into a complete stranger's home, to help them with the question, then go to places that most Americans will never have the chance to go to, even if they want to. We often get behind the scenes to see things that most people would never dream exist, and we get to interview these remarkable people who are a whole lot smarter than we are. What could be better than that?
Well, they're a whole lot smarter as far as what they're into, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know,
the people are great. I always say that I think one of the best, the two best parts is one. Wes and I have probably been everywhere. Actually, I haven't been to Hawaii, but we're working on that. And the people,
right?
You know, it's really the people
because of their enthusiasm.
Well, yeah, their enthusiasm, their knowledge.
That's right, and it's important for everybody to remember the story is not about the detectives; it's about the people we're talking to in the investigation that we're working on for an actual person.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org to speak with Wes Cowan or Elise Luray from the PBS History Detectives. It airs on Monday night at 9 p.m. on WOSU-TV. Let's listen to another cut. This one is from, again, the same season 8, and it's episode 3. It's called Baker's Golden. In this episode, Wes is investigating the origins of an unusual drawing from the time of the gold rush. It could be from a famous photographer's journal. In this scene, Wes is reading from photographer Isaac Baker's journal.
Oh, and here's his first view of San Francisco. And you'll get the sense of what the guy's like. San Francisco, a beautiful country, romantic scenery, excellent harbor, a fine climate, and plenty of game. This is the place for me in the winter season. And then in the next breath, it is the most degraded, immoral, uncivilized, and dirty place that can be imagined. And the sooner we're away from here, the better for us.
Wes, that ultimately had nothing to do with your sleuthing, but it did just again humanize.
Well, in fact, I would
I would respectfully disagree that it had a lot to do with my sleuthing, because we found out a lot about Isaac Baker from reading his journals, what kind of a sense of humor he had that he then transferred into this fantastic drawing. That was just a great story, one of my favorite stories that I've done in 8 years with the show. I mean, it took me up into the California gold fields where I'd never been before. I got to look at these incredible diaries of this early gold miner who had this fabulous sense of humor, and I got to visit the Oakland Museum of History and look at the work that he did as a daguerreotypist.
You know, I thought it was going to be one of those shows where maybe it didn't turn out the way it was anticipated, because his drawings, and for instance, that journal that you were reading from, his drawings were much different in that than they were.
Sure. But, you know, it was one of those stories where at the end you just couldn't believe that all this stuff existed and we were able to confirm what we suspected all along, and then add a little to it.
And he did some incredible portraits that I actually recognized, of the Indian boy, the Native American Indian, and then the Chinese man. They were the Chinese man was one of the first known photographic portraits.
Well, it was the first photograph of a Chinese worker in the gold fields.
Okay.
But yeah, they're iconic images, particularly the Chinese laborer. Yeah. That's been published a million times in various publications.
614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Paul, you're on the air. You want to talk about the theremin?
Just a comment. It's still in use.
Oh, sure. As I said, I don't know if you just heard me a little while ago, but the gentleman who we interviewed, Robert, was at Madison Square Gardens that night performing with the theremin for a show that was a tribute to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
It was Simon and Garfunkel's reunion tour that came through Columbus a few years ago. One of their backup people was playing a theremin. And what you didn't mention that I thought was interesting, it's the only instrument that you play without touching it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you watch the show, you'll see that we talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
I actually tried to play it. It didn't do very successfully.
Well,
it's a really hard instrument to play, but you're correct in saying that you don't use your hands. I mean,
you don't touch it.
You use your hands with the antenna and on the side.
And the other thing interesting about Leon Theremin was that in the early 1900s, he was a white man who married a black dancer, and that was pretty much unheard of at the time. Anyway, just nice show. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul.
Well, thank you for your comments.
Yeah, the expert that you were talking to, Elise, on that score said it's one of the easiest to play, but one of the most difficult to play well. I think is what he said. You can get a sound out of it,
Elise,
but
said she wasn't playing it. Well, I thought she was playing it.
I thought you did.
The gentleman, Paul, is correct. I mean, you don't. If you watch the segment, you'll see you use your hands, but you don't touch the instrument, which is why I think it's so hard to do.
Yeah, it's very, very odd. We're going to have to take another break, and then we'll return with Wes Cowan and Elise Luray of the PBS History Detectives. It airs on WOS-TV Monday night at 9 p.m. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library, ColumbusNeighborhoods.org features over 30 neighborhoods in and around Columbus and allows users to tell their own stories, post their own photos and video, and contribute to the collective story of Columbus. To be a part of this multimedia public engagement project or to learn more, visit ColumbusNeighborhoods.org.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. We'll hear about women's struggle for acceptance and equality in the legal and judicial professions. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency, Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses for 155 years. 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.
84 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40 this morning. Sunshine today and another hot day with a high of 95. There is a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 71, and then it's going to cool off for Friday, cooler temperatures and cloudy skies, and a chance of rain, maybe a thunderstorm for Friday, a high of 82. Rain for Friday night as well, a low of 62 degrees, and then sunny for Saturday and a high of 85. All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests, Wes Cowan and Elise Luray, PBS History Detectives. Show airs on Monday nights at 9 p.m. on WOSU-TV. If you want to know more about the History Detectives, you can go online. Go to WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you to do that. If you want to speak with Elise or Wes, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Some of the sources in your stories struck me. There was the librarian in the Copperhead Kane case who teared up over her connection with the subject in that case. People can get very, very emotional. Do sources sometimes not want to be filmed? They don't want to be involved. Does anybody ever turn you down?
Oh yeah.
What do you do?
What do we do, Wes? We put them on camera.
Well, I think that people don't want to be involved. We never hear about them because they don't use them as somebody that they don't
Let
use them as somebody
that,
on camera.
Though. Right. It's not wanting to be involved. Some people don't want to be on camera.
Okay.
So, and that's totally acceptable if they're not comfortable. And if that's the case, we figure out some way to use the information from them but not put them on camera. So there may be somebody that wants to help us do the research but just doesn't necessarily feel comfortable going on national television. And that's totally fine.
Have either of you ever traveled to Ohio to look at something for History Detectives?
Are you kidding?
Ohio.
There have been many stories in Ohio. I did one last year about a guy in, I think it was, boy, now I'm going to be, he was in Chillicothe, and he owned what he had heard was a bomb that was supposed to be put into a grave. And we investigated the story and found out that, in fact, this was a bomb that was invented in the last quarter of the 19th century. It was called a grave torpedo, and it was meant to be buried in the grave above a coffin to prevent grave robbers.
Oh, was that common?
Well, it was common enough that the local newspapers carried stories about grave robbing, and there were some folks, I think in Newark, some grave robbers who were actually killed when one of these grave torpedoes exploded when they were trying to rob a grave. But the backside of the story was of course about the object, but the backside of the story was about the development of medical schools in the United States, and before about 1885, there were laws that prevented medical schools from obtaining cadavers. Mm-hmm. And the only way that students could learn gross anatomy was on a human body, and so there was a huge market for cadavers. Mm.
I've heard about that. Okay. 614-292-8513. Richard, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Oh, sorry. Sorry. Jumped the gun on that one. No pun intended. When you do travel to a long ways to do something, do you try to do more than one show at the same time? Are you ever working on two shows at the same time, I guess I should say?
No. Well, that's not true. I mean, you could be on a shoot working on a show and getting scripts for your next show, but you're really concentrated on shooting that segment.
How do you weave it into your schedule, Wes? How does it work that way?
It's very difficult. You know, my company here in Cincinnati employs 18 people full-time, and we have a major auction about once a month, you know, and sometimes more than once a month. So, I have a great staff that really runs the business almost without me. But B, I have last season, told the producers of History Detectives I need to be here a little more frequently than I have been in the first 7 seasons. So I really cut back on my shooting schedule to doing only 4 last year. May go back to doing more this current year, but it's a juggling act for me.
Sure, Elise, what else do you still work at Christie's or?
No, I'm an independent auctioneer. Not like Wes, I don't have my own house. I auctioneer for
okay.
other people, and I'm also a mother. So a single mother. So for me, the juggling is mainly, you know, 2 boys, and I have one going into 6th grade and one going into 3rd grade. So
my biggest
juggler are my children.
Yeah, exactly. All righty. Here's Richard. Richard, welcome to the show. Sorry about that.
That's quite all right.
Hi, Richard.
I was interested in the funding source for the program, and if it's stable in the Great Recession, I was afraid that you might be disappearing because of the lack of funding, but you don't seem to be. So is it secure?
Well, we're never secure, which is why we're always asking people to donate to PBS.
Yeah, well, of course, I do that regularly.
Thank you very much. And, you know, it really is the donations to PBS that keep us on board.
So that's the major funding. It's not some outside corporation or corporations or...
No, PBS...
Or rich people or...
PBS funds the... Funds the production for History Detectives, and it's as far as I know, History Detectives is entirely dependent upon people like yourself and other viewers in other cities. We do know that the show was renewed for next year for a 9th season, but typically we won't know really
yeah.
until next year. Whether it will be picked up again, who knows? I mean, you know, in the history of a television show, for any show to be on as long as History Detectives is remarkable. And
that's true.
And it's a testament, I think, to the interest that people have in the show.
Well, it's the ultimate reality TV.
We hope
so. Roadshow and History Detectives, I consider 2 of my favorite pair.
Why, thank you.
That's great, and we really appreciate that.
Are you working right now on another series, or is this current set all done and everything is on hold as far as producing new shows until sometime next year?
Well, I still have 1 voiceover that I have to do next week, and I think that's literally the last show. We are actually wrapping next Friday,
uh-huh.
and then we'll go on break in September. We'll start doing research again.
Yeah, and production typically for Elise and me and the other detectives. We typically start filming in late November, early December, and then all the filming is done by about the 3rd week of June. And as the shows, of course, are being assembled throughout that period,
right.
So that the new season begins the last week of June, first week of July.
Mm-hmm. One quick final question.
Okay.
The little device that was with the artwork, have you had any hits on that yet? I knew that you asked for that. I heard Gwendolyn ask that question, and I thought, great, in a week or two I'll hear an answer, but you haven't said anything.
But, you know, I haven't heard anything, Elise. Have you?
Well, I haven't heard anything, but if you look on our website, the PBS website, we certainly had a lot of people inquiring and making guesses,
uh-huh.
but I don't know if that's anything concrete. I don't believe anything concrete has
okay.
come up, or Wes or I would have heard, you know. If you post something on Facebook on our website, a lot of times you get comments, but I don't know if any of them
right.
have been.
Well, I
great.
Hope you get a big hit. It seemed like there was an arrow pointing at a certain person, but no confirmation.
Well,
right, that's right.
I think that some people think it was actually Jack Kennedy is who they're referring to.
Yeah.
Well, I
Kennedy.
Think, yeah, that's who the name, the pseudonym was clever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Richard, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Richard.
Just to remind everybody, supporting WOSU-TV helps pay for History Detectives. It's, pretty much individual viewer contributions that make up the bulk of funding for all public media in the United States. So,
no question about that, and it's something that we're happy to plug anytime that we possibly can, not because we're employed doing this show for public television. But, you know, gosh, it's really about the only thing that I watch. And if it weren't for public radio, I don't know what I'd do to get my news and get my information throughout the day.
Me too. I stream it.
I agree. Lise, how did you get from Christie's to the History Detectives?
The same way Wes did. We were both appraisers on the Antiques Roadshow. And they came around, the producers of Lion Television came around to the Antiques Roadshow and asked people to actually do a screen test, and they picked the two of us.
It seems like History Detective is sort of an extrapolation of the Antiques Roadshow.
It is and it isn't. I mean, we both, I mean, obviously to us, Wes and I, art and antiques are commodities, but I think that we try to show the historical importance of the object much more so than the monetary. I mean, to us, objects obviously have monetary value, and we're often asked, what do you think the monetary value of this piece is? But we're really trying to show the historical importance of the piece.
Yeah, I like to say that the Antiques Roadshow, that History Detectives really sort of picks up where the Antiques Roadshow leaves off. And that is, you know, when you're watching the Antiques Roadshow, you're seeing an appraisal on television, and what you're not seeing really is the research that's gone into coming up with that appraised value. And in the first place, you know, the people you see on the Antiques Roadshow are incredibly smart. They have had years of experience appraising, and so a lot of it is just, you know, right off the, you know, they know what it's worth based upon their experience. But there's also a library and research tools that help the appraisers before they come up with that on the show. But you really don't see that. And so what History Detectives does, I think that it doesn't really focus on the money, as Elise said, but it shows the average viewer how that research is done and points out things that, you know, the average viewer can do for themselves to discover information about an object or a story that they might have.
Do you hear stories about folks following your lead and making discoveries on their own?
Oh, all the time.
Oh, yeah, all the time. You know, I think also when we first started doing the Antiques Roadshow, which was in like the early 90s, there was no eBay. There was no, you know, Google was, I don't even know if there was Google at the time. Mm-hmm. The landscape has changed so dramatically that sometimes when people come to us, they've already even started doing their own research. And I know in the roadshow, it can kind of be a problem because people think they have something that they completely don't. But, you know, a lot of times the process has already been started before they get to us. They've usually hit a wall.
They've hit a wall. Is it because, as Wes, I think you mentioned earlier, they just can't get into places that you can get access to?
No, I don't think that's necessarily it. I think it's more that they're not persistent enough.
Right.
That they just don't keep pulling. I like to refer to this pulling as pulling a thread. You know, and you keep pulling the thread to see where it leads.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people just aren't persistent enough to do it. I think that certainly PBS opens a lot of doors.
Yeah.
But
quicker.
But, you know, people ask me all the time, what's it take to be a history detective? And my answer is always persistence.
The copperhead or the brass-handled cane is an example. I thought it was interesting. I suppose anyone could have gotten the answer to the question. But you at first questioned its authenticity because it didn't have sort of the patina on it that you would expect of something that old.
Well, yeah, that's right. And then, you know, as I talked to a foundry person, the person who does this for a living, what makes these things for a living, said, yeah, you know, if somebody's using it a lot, they're going to wear that patina off.
We have an email from Linda. If you'd like to email us, we have about 3.5-4 more minutes with Wes Cowan and Elise Luray of PBS History Detectives. This is from Linda. I have inherited a gorgeous Madonna and Child oil painting that has been in my immediate family since the 1940s. I would love to get some tips on how to research its origins and the painter. It is unsigned as far as we can tell. My dad told me it was found rolled up behind a door in my grandparents' home in Camden, New Jersey. He and my mom thought it may have been a payment to an adopted brother who was a merchant marine. Can one of the detectives comment on how I could track down its history? It would be good to know if I need to insure it separately.
Well, without seeing the painting,
right.
It's kind of tough for me to make to make a really great cogent comment, but here's what I would say, that it sounds to me like she might have, and I would say might have, a copy of an old master painting, you know, from the Renaissance or that sort of era. A lot of these paintings were copied over and over and over and over again for hundreds of years, and she may have that. So I guess where I would start would be, assuming that your listener is from Columbus or in the viewing area,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Columbus Museum of Art is a great place to start with. Go to the library there, make an appointment with the curator of European paintings. That would be where I'd start. Take the painting there.
And then they could find out if it was something familiar that's been repainted.
Absolutely.
Probably pretty quickly.
Absolutely.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'll try to get it on. Elise, Wes, anything coming up that you want to tell people about, make sure that they tune in? Any of the shows?
Well, they're all good.
I know.
You know, we've got great.
But
well, you know, I because I did fewer shows than Elise did, I'm not sure when when my next show will appear.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I shot some great stuff this year, and you know, I think it's just I just would encourage all of the listeners to tune in on Monday night at 9 o'clock.
I would also encourage anybody, if they have anything that they do think that we could investigate, to please submit it to our website at pbs.org.
Yeah, just go on pbs.org, go to History Detectives, and submit your story.
Yeah, I think it's a never-ending story that you both tell. So thanks a lot for joining us today and telling part of it.
Great to be here, and thanks for inviting us.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
Thank you.
That show, the next new episode of History Detectives, airs on WOSU-TV on Monday night at 9 p.m. Tune in then, or you can go online to historydetectives.org?
PBS.org,
yep.
And then to
/History Detectives, yeah.
Or you can Google it, which is how I've done it, and get it very, very easily. And click on the right. You can be watching those old episodes in a twinkle of an eye. Thanks again to Wes Cowan and Elise Luray of PBS History Detectives.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that's all the time we have right now for All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.